I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Here's the thing about bananas. They're the world's most popular fruit crop, with over 100 metric tons produced annually. That's in over 130 countries, tropical and subtropical countries. For me, personally, an inedible banana is one that's too green or one that's too ripe. But actually, there are some varieties in the Goldilocks zone for good bananas, neither too green nor too ripe, and you still wouldn't want to eat them. They're just not desirable in any condition. It's the edible bananas that we have much to do with at all, and of all the edible banana varieties, it's the so-called Cavendish subgroup in the species that are the most common in stores. Now, these Cavendish bananas, they are sterile plants. They don't make seeds. Propagation of these banana trees is by cloning. You take suckers or cuttings and make new trees out of them. So basically, they all have pretty much identical DNA, and that has made them one of your more vulnerable global food crops. That simple fact of the same DNA, that makes them very susceptible to a disease that comes along, a fungus or something. It's like a plague that sweeps through and leaves devastation in its wake. This has happened in the past and could happen in the future. Now, bananas apparently reached the Americas in the 1500s. They originated in Southeast Asia. And ever since coming to the Western Hemisphere, their popularity has only grown. And, of course, they are globally popular now. Remember how I said that today they are the world's most popular fruit crop? I want to underscore that because with that popularity comes demand. And with demand comes an increase in supply. And if you can control the supply, you have great economic power. So ultimately, this big story about the banana is that humans have been competing. They have been vying for generations to be on top of the game. As you may have guessed, with fierce competition, there are rule breakers. There are big corporations. There's regulation. There's government. There's even violence. We thought that today on Constant Wonder, we would take a little bit of time to delve into the broad context of banana production and distribution in history and the stories that have all concluded before we even get to the grocery store to buy one. It's a great pleasure to have with us John Saluri. He's an associate professor and director of global studies in the history department at Carnegie Mellon University. He researches and teaches about the relationship between social and environmental change in modern Latin America. He teaches courses on food, animals, commodities, on U.S.-Latin American relations. And he's going to have an updated edition of his book, Banana Cultures, which originally came out in 2005, a new edition coming out, updated, I believe, in early 2021. It's a great pleasure to have with us John Saluri. Thanks for being with us.
Great. Thanks, Marcus. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
I have had acquaintance with the idea that bananas are in peril today. And it comes up, it makes headlines, about every 6 months, one of the major news networks will say, eat your bananas while you can, kind of a thing. Let's just start with this idea that should we or should we not be worried for our access to and enjoyment of bananas?
Yeah, Marcus, that's a great question, and I think your observation is spot on. And in fact, in the revised edition, I talk about the story of the prospect of the, sometimes they even use words like extinction of the banana, you know, as we know it from a consumer standpoint. So I think I'll go out on a limb here and just give a direct answer to that. And I think the short answer to that is no, I don't think that most consumers should be losing sleep over the imminent prospect that they will not have any bananas arriving to their supermarket. The more complicated story or answer, and maybe more interesting one, is that there is, in fact, a bananas for well over a century now, actually, or about a century, have been plagued by certain pathogens, mostly of a fungal nature, that have indeed become, I hate to use the word, but a pandemic. That is to say, these are pathogens that have crossed oceans. They are found in virtually every major banana, particularly export banana growing region of the world, from the Philippines to Honduras to Costa Rica to Colombia. And so, so there is a legitimate concern, and partly what drives these stories in the media every 6 months or so is partly researchers who are, you know, trying to figure out ways to solve this problem. And in some ways, the book I write does indeed engage and ended up, it wasn't intended to be that, but it focuses a lot around how the banana companies, small-scale banana growers, banana workers, consumers, and businesses were all have been affected by these pathogens.
Well, you know, you haven't really set me totally at ease, even if you were maybe perhaps trying to, because it's more complex than the question of will it be in the stores. Any story like this dealing with essentially the practice of monoculture is a big problem in the world today. Whether or not we can get the bananas, the idea of the way we go about getting these crops is really kind of a sad story.
Right. Well, absolutely. And thanks, Marcus. For the lead, oftentimes the focus on the consumer point of view is, of course, important, but it's only one viewpoint. And I think you're absolutely right that when one looks at the history of this story that I alluded to, of the establishment of banana plantations, and particularly, you say, monoculture is an important word to use, concept. For listeners, maybe think plantation, although I actually think monoculture is a more accurate term. And by that, what I mean is essentially in the case of bananas, you have a perennial crop, right? Meaning a crop that doesn't have to be replanted, typically would not be replanted every year, densely planted for at least the last 50 years or so, usually used with herbicides to control weeds. So, and you have very little diversity, right, in terms of what's growing in those plantations. And then historically, gets to sort of the pandemic idea, these plantations, as they get linked up to commercial networks, tend to have movement of, you know, workers, scientists, the bananas themselves are moving all over the place. And that also can enhance the spread of lead to the spread of the diseases. Now, historically, some of the larger banana companies, they would respond to this by unable to control the disease. Let me actually be a little more specific. So Panama disease is the disease that today tends to get in the news. Okay, there is actually another one that I've had some time I'll allude to. But Panama disease, and there's various sort of strains of Panama disease that have been a problem over the last century or so. But the first time that Panama disease hits the Americas, hits the Caribbean and Central America, in the 1910s, 1920s, by that point, you had a handful of U.S. Banana companies, fruit companies, who were dominating the importation, shipping, and to a certain extent, the growing of bananas. And how they responded to the pathogen initially, unable to find a sort of either a chemical control, which was starting to come in vogue at that time, or finding another variety that they felt like had both disease resistance and indeed would satisfy the consumers, primarily in the United States at this point, they responded by abandoning their diseased farms, clearing additional forest, and replanting. Now, that sounds perhaps kind of reasonable from a company standpoint, but as you can maybe anticipate, some of the costs of that were accelerated rates of deforestation, usually in lowland tropical areas, and also significantly, a lot of disruption, economic disruption at local and regional levels. So you would have workers who would be, you know, lose their jobs or be forced to migrate to these new areas to retain work, to seek out, you know, to continue to work with the banana companies. And there were, in the sort of shadows, so to speak, of these big monocultures and plantations really throughout history and still to the present, there have been smaller scale banana growers who have, you know, I don't want to romanticize the situation, but, you know, they've oftentimes had access to their own land and they would sell their bananas usually to the same banana company. So they certainly didn't always have a great negotiating position, but nevertheless, they were also part of this banana economy. And they, of course, would not necessarily, perhaps since they're of course, but they would oftentimes not have the luxury to abandon their farm, move on to another area and continue to grow. So as the banana companies abandon an area, they would oftentimes leave behind not only the former plantation workers, but sometimes a sort of local or regional banana economy that sort of now gets cut off from the export market and is forced to adapt and make changes.
Well, this Panama disease that you're talking about, this is not the first, and you've already alluded to this, this is not the only disease to come and strike banana plantations. If you go back in history, you chart out different types of fungus that have come along or problems. I'm wondering if you go back 100 years, 100 plus years of banana growing in Central America, if it's kind of been a boom and bust cycle.
Yeah, absolutely. So bananas, you know, people wondering, you know, in the United States, people first started to really eat and see probably bananas on a regular basis in the late 19th century. So let's say 1870s and 80s and into the 1890s, it really starts to take off. And so you have a boom period, generally speaking, when consumption's increasing, production's expanding. And then you have the first wave of this Panama disease comes in, as I mentioned, in the 19-teens and 20s. Now, one interesting thing to keep in mind here, and this is where this gets back to your point about the supermarket not being the only perspective here, is that even as this disease, Panama disease, starts to ravage the plantations, the consumer doesn't see much evidence of this. And this is, again, partly because of what I just alluded to, the company's ability to expand geographically. And this pattern continues to happen. It's probably going to continue to happen today. That is to say, production will shift around, and so that will continue to, you know, provide bananas potentially to consumers. But meanwhile, right, within countries or within regions, you're going to have these boom and bust cycles where you're going to have periods where there's going to be expanding demand, creation of jobs and opportunities, economic opportunities. But then oftentimes you're going to have these periods of collapse and crash. Another pathogen that happens, and indeed to talk about the complexities of this, so in response to Panama disease, which is really the first major pathogen that the big banana companies pay attention to, they do what people still do today, which is oftentimes go and look for disease-resistant varieties. Now, long before the age of genetically modified organisms and such, that involved physically traveling to other places where bananas were found, different kinds of banana varieties, and collecting specimens, trying to very carefully nurture, you know, carry them back so that they would still be viable, and plant them in essentially, you know, gardens and experimental stations in the Caribbean. So this is what the banana companies do. And it's quite possible, it's hard to prove, but it's actually quite possible that somewhat ironically, in the process of bringing over a new banana material to try to combat Panama disease, that in that process, they carried over unwittingly some other pathogens, one of which is known as Sigatoka. Sigatoka, like Panama disease, has some various strains or sort of varieties, but and the name has changed a little bit. But suffice to say, this is like a leaf streak disease. The Panama disease is a soil-borne fungus and enters through the vascular system of the plant. So in other words, it gets taken up into the roots. Sigatoka, in contrast, would be an airborne pathogen, an airborne fungus. It's conceivable it traveled on its own across continents. It's possible, but it's also very likely that it had a little human help and was carried via ships. And as I said, even the same scientists, right, may have inadvertently introduced this pathogen. So Sigatoka, in contrast, is in fact one that the companies are able to develop a chemical control for, something known as Bordeaux spray, which is a copper sulfate that still is actually sometimes used on orchards or some variation of that. It's fairly typical and one of the older kinds of chemical pest controls, or in this case, disease controls, that has been used. Sigatoka, the expansion of the Sigatoka control system was very capital intensive. This is the 1930s now, I should clarify. And right up to the present, that the introduction of these chemical controls did work to control the pathogen, but as often as times the case, one, it added costs. So again, thinking about our small-scale growers, many of them were driven out of the industry because they could not afford the capital expense to control for Sigatoka. And then for the workers doing the application, there's evidence that they would suffer from some kind of pulmonary diseases and impacts, and it may have exacerbated things like tuberculosis by this repeated heavy exposure to copper sulfate. I should clarify, copper is not terribly toxic to people, but nevertheless, there's some evidence that indeed it can accumulate in the lungs. Under certain conditions, it can accumulate in lungs and cause some problems. That relatively, perhaps you could say, innocuous chemical control gave way in the 1960s, in 1970s, and right up to the present, to different forms of chemical pesticides, more that came out as, you know, synthesized in laboratories, that have a host of both ecological as well as potential impacts on human health, particularly, again, for farm workers. Again, this is why not consumers. Don't, frankly, be alarmed. These are not things that you should be concerned about your own health, but if you're concerned about the health of farm workers, you should definitely be concerned about the very high volume of fungicides that are being applied to banana plantations as we speak in places like Costa Rica and Ecuador to control a sort of variant of this Sigatoka, now known as leaf streak disease. Again, just to emphasize the movement of these pathogens, which has been so central to the history of the export banana industry. Sigatoka, the name, comes from a valley in Fiji where it was sort of first noticed and sort of said to have originated. Whether that's true or not, that's sort of hence just to give you a sense of the ability of these pathogens to move.
Well, now that you've mentioned Fiji, I just have to ask, the whole story of plantations in Central America, it doesn't go back very far because they're not native to Central America in the first place, are they?
Absolutely. Bananas and plantains and musas, sort of the generic name used for, you know, both things like what we'd call banana, what most people think of banana in the trade, known as a dessert banana, something that's got a higher sugar content. Plantains, which are people in the U.S. are becoming more familiar with, is more of a cooking banana. That's actually, cooking bananas are by far the most important from a nutritional and kind of culinary perspective, right? In most tropical places in the world, like Africa, like South Asia, Southeast Asia, where in fact bananas were first domesticated in South and Southeast Asia thousands of years ago, they reach places like India and parts of Africa. Also probably more than a millennia ago for sure. And the arrival in the Americas, actually, interestingly enough, is somewhat debated. But we know for sure in the Caribbean and Central America, that banana would have been introduced with the arrival of European colonizers 500 years ago or so. It did spread pretty quickly, so quickly that some people, observers, you know, say in the 1500s even, or say the 1600s, speculated that it might have been native because it, so apparently did both was able to propagate quickly and presumably was popular with native people as well as, you know, enslaved Africans who would be brought over and would oftentimes turn to plantains as a kind of form of subsistence food that they would grow in the land that they could find, you know, they could access next to, say, a sugarcane plantation.
Well, we're going to take a short break and then return to the topic here. We're visiting with John Saluri and talking about the banana, the status of the banana today, and the history behind it all. We're going to give him a challenge when we come back and see if he can't work into this fairly tame story so far a little bit of controversy. Like, was the CIA ever involved? Were people screaming about communists? And how does that work into the banana story? Stay tuned to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. You're listening to Constant Wonder. John Saluri is with the History Department at Carnegie Mellon University. He's author of Banana Cultures, which came out in 2005, an updated edition coming out in early 2021. We're going to learn more about the history of banana culture and the politics of banana culture in Central America than you probably ever heard before. Of course, we've all heard the term banana republic, and I'm assuming that some of this story of controversy, of coup d'etat, of warfare, of big business getting involved, with the CIA even being involved. It's the Banana Republic term is going to make a little bit more sense once we have this next conversation with John. CIA, toppling leaders of countries, big corporations, even the Chiquita Company that when I was a kid, that just seemed innocuous. You just have some dancing lady singing about fruit, you know?
Yeah, absolutely, Marcus. And so, but you're right, that Miss Chiquita definitely belies a much sort of darker and more problematic history, to say the least. And really from almost the get-go in the early 20th century, right up into the 1990s, the U.S. banana companies, Chiquita Brands, formerly known as United Fruit Company, has gained infamy, certainly in Latin America, as a company that had such economic, that sort of transformed its economic power into political power, and would cut all kinds of deals with political leaders in Central America to get access to land concessions, to get access to tax breaks, to get access to the right to import labor to help drive down labor costs. And there's a whole hidden history that is only partially understood and known, but certainly widely known within Latin America, that's taken on legend of the company supporting, forcefully removing people from their land in order to, take their land for planting, and also for violently repressing labor strikes. There's some very famous examples in Colombia that actually the deceased Nobel laureate writer Gabriel Garcia Marquez in 100 Years of Solitude dedicates some time to telling this story, his kind of fictionalized version of a real event in which a number of striking banana workers were ruthlessly killed. Again, whether directly by United Fruit employees is, of course, murky and somewhat lost in time at this point, but certainly the United Fruit Company was the instigator there. And then in terms of, the CIA, perhaps the most infamous and maybe well-known story that people have at least vaguely heard of is in 1954, as the Cold War was really taking off between the United States and the Soviet Union. In Guatemala, in Central American country Guatemala, they were actually enjoying what was known at the time as the Guatemalan Spring, in which after years of dictatorship, a dictator that had done lots of business with the United Fruit Company in the 20s and 30s, they elected democratically a series of governments that tried to start to implement certain amount of reform, legalized formation of labor unions, think about issuing some land reform. They had horribly skewed distribution of land in Guatemala. So there was a effort proposed to start to take idle lands, right, and redistribute those to some of the poor rural people who did not have land to be able to, to cultivate. And United Fruit Company, which as part of its policy, probably linked to Panama disease, held a lot of land in reserve. So they would have immense land holdings that they would have title to or legal use rights to hold, but they'd only be cultivating a much smaller portion of the land that they actually claim to own. So in Guatemala, when Jacobo Arbenz, who is the president who gets elected, actually the second president as part of this Guatemalan Spring, himself a former military leader, by no means any affiliation with the radical left at the time, he starts to look very much interested in modernizing his country. And so he is interested in sees land reform as a mechanism by which to do that, which actually at the time, I should add, land reform was not considered. During the Cold War, it's going to become much more associated in Latin America with leftist movements. But in fact, it was widely considered a reasonable sort of thing to do, or it wasn't so tied to any particular political ideology. So that said, as Arbenz starts to promote land reform, the United Fruit Company gets very alarmed as Arbenz starts to target United Fruit Company's idle lands. And in a familiar situation, what Arbenz does is when he goes to expropriate, he says, okay, United Fruit, you have listed for years in your tax records the value of this land that you have sitting idle. We're going to pay you for the value that you've listed it as, and we are going to, take this land and we're going to use it and redistribute it. Well, United Fruit, of course, immediately says, oh, well, actually, that land is worth a lot more than what, we list in our tax records, and we're not very happy about this situation. So at the time in the 1950s, United Fruit Company had some executives and some lawyers who worked for it who were extremely well connected to the Eisenhower administration, knowing very high level, actually having some friends and colleagues of the brother of the president, Eisenhower, some friends in the State Department. And so United Fruit both used their sort of back channel, so to speak, to make discrete inquiries to the State Department and start to call attention to the way that Arbenz was government and land reform was potentially going to threaten their economic interest. And meanwhile, they also launched a much more public kind of PR campaign of propaganda, trying to portray Arbenz as a communist. And eventually, fairly quickly, Eisenhower, following 1953, right, where the CIA successfully also, in a covert operation, overthrew the prime minister of Iran, the U.S., you know, now the CIA, very confident in its ability to do this, decides to do a similar thing in Guatemala. And so what they do is they train a force, a small force, actually, in Honduras. They recruit and try to find some, you know, people who are willing to oppose our bends. And they basically stage a coup in 1954. They provide some air support. They provide a lot. The U.S. provides a lot of training and propaganda materials. And of course, they diplomatically try to, you know, convince other Latin American countries they should go along with this. And so our bends, as bombs are dropping on the capital city, as there's reports of this armed group that's opposing the government marching into from Honduras into Guatemala, our bends flees the country. And new government comes in power. So a military official with the support of the United States is put into place. And then, as often happens, the U.S. Government gets a little more than it bargained for, insofar as rather than having a perhaps, you know, a less communist-friendly, less land reform-oriented democracy come to power in Guatemala, you have a long series of military dictatorships come to power that are going to be very ruthless in putting down any kind of political opposition. It's going to give rise to exactly what the United States was trying to avoid, presumably, which were leftist armed guerrilla movements, which were not particularly tied to the Soviet Union, but were indeed very much trying to overthrow military dictatorship. And all of this culminates in a very horrifying civil war that peaks in the 1980s when there's what actually many observers have characterized as a genocide is carried out by the Guatemalan military government against particularly indigenous people in Guatemala. And throughout that time, I should say, United Fruit was not necessarily as deeply involved by the 1960s in Guatemala. The U.S. government, on the other hand, though, would indeed continue to be deeply involved in supporting governments in Guatemala. So to come back to your point, yes, the United Fruit was deeply involved in this 1954 coup in calling attention and getting the ear of the State Department that did eventually lead to the CIA operation. I should add that more recently, as recently, again, as well, not so recent for many people in the 1990s, and even in the 2000s, Chiquita Brands, the formerly United Fruit, would continue to be linked to making payments to armed paramilitary groups who were carrying out violent acts in places like Colombia, and also trying to influence political activities through bribes and such in Guatemala as recently as the 1990s.
I've been listening to this story unfold, and it all goes back to bananas.
Yes, it does come back to bananas, which is, as I said, is why partly when I start off talking about bananas, and why bananas, you know, as a researcher, these things like bananas, coffee, chocolate, you know, they kind of fascinate me because they're things that we don't probably normally think of when we think about, you know, politics, geopolitics, CIA, covert operations. We don't necessarily think of these seemingly mundane bananas, right? This fruit that, you know, is very inexpensive, that seems to always be in our supermarkets. And yet, exactly, it is deeply, you know, shaped these histories of both international relations as well as economic histories and the environmental transformations, really throughout the Caribbean and Central America, you know, into Colombia as well and Ecuador. So it is quite indeed remarkable, as you say, that bananas have indeed been so tightly tied to this.
Well, I have to ask you now, as we conclude, I'm not going to ask you to be prescriptive and say whether or not I should purchase and eat bananas, conventionally grown bananas or organic or otherwise. I'm just very interested in the fact that whether it's today, anything that we consume, the food that's an import, that comes from vast tracts of land where large corporations are involved. You've said, I've seen you on video online saying that when you were defending your dissertation, a lot of people that showed up in the crowd weren't fellow historians, but they were people interested in the new trends in agriculture and where the new ag is going. Is there Is there a lesson to be learned aside from just saying, Marcus, eat fewer bananas?
Right. Yeah, no, Marcus, great question. Thank you for that. I think there is a lesson to be learned, and I think it's one that actually still kind of already exists in a sense that there are bananas can, in fact, be grown, you know, on a smaller scale. And I think that trade policies, for example, and I didn't even have time to really get into this, that as you, for your listeners, can probably easily imagine, powerful companies are tend to be more effective at influencing the nitty-gritty details of trade agreements than, say, small-scale farmers in, say, Trinidad or Ecuador or Honduras are. And the extent that consumers can try to envision trade policies that can actually encourage production, possibly organic or at least more sustainable, of smaller-scale farmers, then potentially we do a couple of things. One, we create livelihoods for small-scale farmers, and also potentially reduce, in a sense, the political power or the kind of we don't create these conditions where one company or one entity can become so powerful that it becomes easier for it to manipulate, you know, politics. I should add as a cautionary note that, or just as a, again, a complicating factor, it is important to recognize things do change. And at this point, the U.S. banana companies are, in fact, economically and politically much less powerful than they used to be. And you now oftentimes have, say, if there's an Ecuadorian family that has been extremely powerful in Ecuador that in some ways now plays the role that United Fruit, in a sense, used to play in terms of dominating the politics and the economies of the Ecuador. And I mention Ecuador because it continues to be the world's biggest exporter. So it's just to say that even an enlightened consumer, so to speak, in the United States who is concerned about, say, U.S. trade policy, it is certainly important to recognize that there are very powerful interests in countries like Ecuador. Chiquita is actually now owned by a Brazilian family firm, as a matter of fact. So there's, you know, nothing changes. Things change. Nothing stays the same historically. And so things are complicated. So I'm not sure that's a very satisfactory answer to your question. I think it makes sense.
Let me just put it where it's going to stick here, which is you eat bananas probably.
I do eat bananas. I do try to eat organic bananas. I try to remind myself that in itself does not make me a, you know, more virtuous person, but I simply do it because there is evidence that it means the worker who grew those bananas was exposed to fewer potentially carcinogens, and it potentially means that there are some smaller scale growers involved. And yeah, it's a lifeline. It's not transforming their lives, probably, honestly, but it's acknowledging them and it's throwing, in a sense, a lifeline to people and trying to encourage people to think about different ways of getting away from big plantations and monocultures that are dependent on heavy use of fertilizers, heavy use of synthetic chemicals that pretty much everybody knows is not really ultimately sustainable. And these alternatives are sort of out there, and it's really getting people to actually overcome the cynicism, right, and actually try to recognize that actually there really are alternatives to these things. Bananas, as I said, I'll just maybe end here. They've been cultivated for thousands of years. Vast majority of that time, there were no synthetic fertilizers, no synthetic pesticides. There is no United Fruit or Chiquita Company. People grew them. They spread. People ate them. They cooked them in delicious and exciting ways. And I suspect that could indeed happen in the next 1,000 years.
It's a pleasure to hear this from you and to learn from you. Thank you so much, John, for being with us.
Great. Thank you, Marcus, for having me again. My pleasure. Have a great day.
John Saluri with us. He is author of Banana Cultures and a new edition coming out in 2021. Round about the same time when Central American countries were going bananas, prodded along, of course, with a little bit of help from that friend up north, the USA. The USA, for its part, was getting on board with the European craze of establishing colonies and empire. Our big move in empire building during this time was picking a fight with Spain, 1898, I believe. And that fight netted us a claim to what had previously been Spanish territories. A lot of new real estate for us. But the whole thing actually began earlier than even that, with American claims to some godforsaken islands in the Pacific which had nothing of interest beyond piles and piles of bird guano. We're going to talk about this bird poop and the American Empire when Constant Wonder returns. Fascinating history. Kind of messy. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. How far does America extend? Where are the outer limits? Well, it's a question of what our map should look like. Here's a conversation I had with Daniel Immerwahr, a history professor at Northwestern University. He's author of How to Hide an Empire, A History of the Greater United States. We pick up the question here with, what would a proper map of the United States look like?
In the 19th century, it was common to call the people who lived in the United States Americans, but it wasn't very common for leading figures in the United States to refer to their country as America, partly because they understood the Americas to encompass South America as well. And it was right at this moment of rapid imperial expansion for the United States. And as a result of an 1898 war with Spain, the United States claimed Guam, Puerto Rico. It claimed Hawaii and American Samoa. It claimed the Philippines. And right after that, because old terms like United States and Republic didn't seem to capture the political character of the country, that's when you see a quick and decisive shift to America, which is a broader term, and it doesn't say anything about the political character of the place.
Now, one of the most curious things about your account is that the story right near the very beginning has to do with some uninhabited islands, and these islands were everywhere, it seems. Tell us about Guano Islands. What were they? Where were they? Nobody was there, and we wanted them for some reason.
Yeah, one of my favorite subjects. So if you think about what the United States looks like, if you just sort of call to mind in your head a map of it, you'll often call to mind just a contiguous blob. And what turns out is that those borders that you're imagining right now, those only accurately depict the United States for 3 years of its history. There's 3 years of U.S. history where those are the borders, partly because in the 18th century and the early 19th century, as everyone knows, the United States was smaller, but also because right after it filled out that familiar profile, the United States started expanding overseas. And the first form of expansion that took, which started in 1857, was a series of islands, ultimately nearly 100 of them, in the Pacific and the Caribbean. As you said, these islands were uninhabited. They were small, but nevertheless, they were really important because they had bird droppings on them. And it sounds like that would just be why would you care about that? But in the 19th century, those bird droppings, dried bird droppings that had been sort of baked in the sun for, decades, millennia even, were such a pungent and concentrated source of nitrates that they were, like the best fertilizer around. And in nitrogen-parched farms, a lot of which were on the east coast of the United States, they could take declining acres and just sort of bring them back to life. So there was this rush to get as many of these islands as possible and to scrape them clean to support U.S. agriculture.
So there was this piece of legislation called the Guano Act that happened in 1856?
Yeah. So every other time that the United States had expanded, there'd always been some debate about it. Is the Louisiana Purchase constitutional? How much of Mexico should the United States claim in the war? The Guano Islands Act was really interesting because what it did is it sort of preemptively licensed annexations. It said that any U.S. citizen who comes across a guano-bearing uninhabited island anywhere in the world can personally annex that island to the United States, and then you have to file some paperwork, and then ultimately the government has to ratify the claim. But basically, individuals could then annex little uninhabited islands throughout the Pacific and the Caribbean to the United States, and they did. So over the course of the next half century, 94 islands were annexed in that way.
So this is as if I were named Cortez, and I didn't even need the monarchy to bless me. And I just went out on my own and I went to Mexico City and I said, I found gold here, so I'm going to claim this whole place for my country and I'll take it. But the gold was bird droppings.
The gold was bird droppings. In fact, they called it white gold.
Oh, they did? I thought I made that up.
Too much, right?
Well, this is just utterly bizarre. It's just finders keepers, losers weepers.
Yeah, that's right. Now, it is important to recognize that the caveat on this law was that the islands be uninhabited. And that was an important part of the congressional debate. Congressmen didn't want this to license willy-nilly annexation of any island anywhere, as long as, you know, some bird had defecated somewhere near it. But it would just be uninhabited islands. And that was a way for the government to make sure that it, even though it was annexing land and it was sort of giving over the power to annex land to private citizens, that it wouldn't accidentally annex people who would then have to be incorporated into the republic.
Yeah, if those people were there, what party poopers, I just have to say, you know.
What
about the other countries feeling like, hey, U.S., don't do this?
Well, so there's two kinds of, hey, U.S., don't do this. First of all, the United States was not the only country looking for guano. There, it had imperial rivals, and particularly it had Britain as an imperial rival. The thing, in fact, that had set the United States off on this bizarre historical course is that Britain had locked down some of the richest guano islands through a British monopoly that were Peruvian sovereignty off the coast of Peru, but the British controlled the trade. And it was the worry that the British were going to lock the United States out of this trade and be able to hike prices that turned guano into a major political issue. It came up multiple times in Congress. Presidents spoke about it. You know, we understand this is a very important issue. We're on it. But there's another kind of, hey, United States, don't do this kind of objection. And that comes from the countries that had sovereignty claims or made sovereignty claims over these islands. So one of the most disputed and important guano islands in U.S. history is an island called Navassa, which is near Haiti. And Haiti made a claim to the island, said that this island belongs to Haiti. It was uninhabited, so those kinds of sovereignty claims are harder to enforce. But that question, is Navassa Island actually part of the United States or does it belong to Haiti? That turned out to be a pretty important question.
You know, in all of my acquaintance with American history, whenever I've thought about our reach out across the oceans, and when I've thought about islands and territories, I never knew where these came from. And now it seems like the Guano Act was a huge kind of thing that propelling us forward out to look outward towards these islands. I had just assumed we needed airstrips for World War II. Is there a bridge from the Guano Islands to the World War II story?
Yeah, there's two connections. One is that that Guano Islands Act is the first thing that licenses the United States to expand overseas, which it had never done before. Alaska follows shortly after, and then by the end of the century, the United States has a very sizable colonial empire. So in that way, the Guano Islands are the legal foundation. But there's a more direct bridge than that, which is this. The same thing that makes those Guano Islands attractive landing spaces for seabirds also often makes them attractive landing spaces for planes. So some of those Guano Islands got repurposed in the age of aviation to be military bases and landing strips. And in fact, it is on her way to one such Guano Island, Howland Island, that Amelia Earhart's plane goes down. She was trying to hit Howland Island. And of course she was, because if you're going around the world, if you're crossing the Pacific, you need an island in the middle of nowhere where you can land.
So this is before World War II, and that sets the stage for an American aviation presence, if not a military presence, all over the place.
That's right. And one of the things that the Japanese did the day after Pearl Harbor is bombed that same island, Howland Island, because they understood the value, the strategic value for the United States of such a well-placed airstrip in the Pacific. That attack by Japan wasn't just an attack on Pearl Harbor alone. It was conceived as a sort of Pacific blitzkrieg, whereby Japan would attack a number of colonial holdings of the United States, some of Britain, and also the independent kingdom of Thailand. And it was all supposed to happen on the same day. Now, the idea of a day is a little confusing because some of the targets were on one side of the international dateline, some of them were on the other, which is why Japan remembers December 8th as the day when this all went down rather than December 7th, because from Tokyo's perspective, that's when it was. But nevertheless, these attacks were all happened within hours, were nearly simultaneous, and the Army's official history rated the attack in the Philippines as militarily as bad as the attack on Pearl Harbor. It took out the backbone of the U.S. Air Force that would have defended the entire Far East. And if we talk more than just militarily, the attack on the Philippines is far worse, because the attack on Pearl Harbor was just that. It was an attack. The Japanese attacked. They did damage, and they didn't come back. Whereas in the Philippines, Japanese forces attacked, and then they continued attacking, and then they invaded and occupied and conquered the Philippines and held it for much of World War II, which was an absolutely brutal occupation. So that's the single largest colony the United States has ever had was Japanese held for much of the war.
And the Philippines then at that time was America's. It belonged to the United States. They would salute the Stars and Stripes, I'm guessing.
That's right. No, they would salute the Stars and Stripes. They would circulate money that had U.S. leaders on it. It was a U.S. territory in the same way that Hawaii was a U.S. territory. And in fact, whether a territory counts as, quote unquote, America was an interesting question at the time, and it was clearly one that FDR wrestled with in his speech. Hawaii had a significantly larger white population, not majority, but larger, and it was closer to North America. So my sense is that he felt like it was a sort of better target to focus on in making the cause for war. But the Philippines was also U.S. territory, and I think FDR was just worried that if he emphasized the Philippines in his speech, as his first draft of his speech did, people in the U.S. mainland might not see that really as cause for war.
Yeah, Hawaii, as I remember, is closer to the California coast, so it seems like maybe the threat was impending. It was closer.
Yeah, that's part of it. There's a categorical distinction between Hawaii and Alaska and the further Western Pacific territories. The Hawaii and Alaska were classified as incorporated territories. All of them were still sort of possessions of the United States, but the incorporation suggested that they were somehow more American than the other ones, and that had a lot to do with the history of white settlement. Those were the two territories that had the largest white populations.
And just very, very briefly, we were talking about the Guano Islands. Guam, Midway, Wake Island, I mentioned those earlier. Were any of those Guano Islands to begin with?
None of them were claimed as part under the Guano Islands Act, but they were, once the United States was claiming Guano Islands left and right, it also took Midway and Wake. Guam was inhabited, so that's a different kind of thing, and it took it in the war of 1898 with Spain.
Let's talk a little bit now about another aspect of World War II that you treat in your book, and it has to do with the internment camps. I am here in Utah. We had internment camps in Utah for American citizens with Japanese heritage. You expand that story far beyond anything I've ever heard before, because there were internment camps not within states, I guess.
Right. So what I try to do in my book is tell U.S. history, but tell it where the United States, the thing I'm telling you the history of, is not just the contiguous blob, but it's the entire United States, so all of the land over which Washington claims jurisdiction. And when you do that, a lot of times historical episodes that are familiar, like the story of Japanese incarceration, come out differently. And that's a really good example of it. So on the one hand, there are other internments that happen. There's a brutal internment of Japanese ancestry individuals that takes place in the Philippines. It starts immediately after Pearl Harbor, and it affects about 30,000 Japanese descended people who live in the Philippines. It is accompanied by summary executions, by sort of ransacking of homes. We have accounts of sexual violence. It doesn't last as long because the Japanese quickly invade the Philippines and liberate the camps. But that's a huge event, and we never talk about it when we tell the story of Japanese internment. There's also a quite serious internment that happens in Alaska, part of which was also Japanese occupied. In order to protect the part of Alaska that Japan hadn't taken, the United States cleared it of its native population and then interned Alaska natives from the Aleutian Islands, interned them in Alaska in these underprepared camps in very harsh conditions. There was a 10% death rate over the course of the war in those camps, as a lot of the people who were interned, not because they were suspected of aiding the enemy, just because they were in the way, were just left to rot in these camps. And you can also tell stories about detaining of people in Hawaii and in Guam as well.
On a very personal level, and this is really innocuous, when I think about the military bases, the legacy of where the United States has had a military presence across the globe since World War II, and in very large measure it's the legacy, the military legacy of us having participated in, all over the world. I lived of all places, in Vienna for a time. And because my father had been in the Navy, and I didn't know this, but because I had a military ID card, I could have purchased peanut butter when I was living there. And the people I knew who were, you know, expats from the United States who didn't have a military thing, they were just envious, and they couldn't believe I wasn't buying peanut butter. You know, that seems really banal. But it just kind of tells me that wherever the military has been, peanut butter goes, or American influence goes. Tell us about that.
Yeah. That's exactly right. I don't think the peanut butter is banal at all. So what you have to, because what it tells you is that there are these little enclaves of the United States that are sprinkled all over the globe, places where you can get peanut butter if you want. But that's not the only thing that you can get. You're right that they become sort of beacons for U.S. influence.
Well, and if it's not peanut butter, it might be pop culture.
That's right. So one of the sort of most delicious examples of this is the British city of Liverpool. Liverpool had been a port city, but it hadn't been a particularly aggressive or advanced cultural city until after World War II, when suddenly it just lit up like a Christmas tree. And there's all these rock bands coming out of Liverpool, like 500 of them, we think. And they're all just sort of working the nightclub circuit. And you have this question. Why? What is going on in Liverpool particularly? Well, it turns out that Liverpool is in the shadow of the single U.S. largest U.S. Air Force base in Europe, and just so much money flows in and out of that base, and a lot of what they call then called race records, which are records featuring African-American musicians, were also flowing in and out of the base. And so, you know, imagine you're growing up in Liverpool at the time. You know, there's this incredibly rich group of people who live in this enclave who are coming out in the nightclubs, who are demanding entertainment of a certain kind, and who have records, who have musical instruments, who have access to all this stuff. And, you know, if you're a young kid, at least the accounts we have of young kids who grew up there, that's a pretty interesting place to be. So take the Beatles. John's mother was known as what they called a good time girl, and whatever that meant. She had an admirably up-to-date record collection, which John and Paul raided. George Harrison used to just steal records from the nearby shop, which was brimming with all these hits from across the Atlantic. And Ringo Starr's stepdad worked on the base, and he would just give Ringo all the records and comic books that he got on the base. So it's not entirely an accident that the Beatles grew up really knowing how to play Buddy Holly songs very well. The Beatles were a bass band.
This is such a sweeping story, and we're not going to touch on it all. In fact, we are out of time. But what a remarkable way to look at these the global reach of the United States, to look at our past colonialism, our present influence all around the world. It's a marvelous book. Daniel Immerwahr, a pleasure to have a chance to learn about it with you.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Daniel Immerwahr is the author of Hide and Empire, A History of the Greater United States. Join us tomorrow on Constant Wonder. We're going to take a visit to the Museum of Bad Art and have a conversation about how some works of art rise to the level of truly impressive awfulness. You know, so bad they're good. That's Constant Wonder tomorrow. Our show is a production of BYU Radio.